Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to the show. This week's edition of Risky Business is sponsored by the wonderful, attractive and stupendously intelligent people at Tenable Network Security. So if you're in the market for some scanning software or a security information event management console, I would suggest you go and check them out. Now, I'm fresh back from AusCert's security conference on the Gold Coast, and if you haven't checked out our special coverage of that event yet, then please go and have a look. In all, I put up 21 podcasts in 5 days, including presentations and interviews. And you can find that at itradio.com.au/AusCert08. All one word. And I'd like to take this chance to thank Josh Bell, my production assistant, for a job very well done at the conference at AusCert. I'd also like to say a special hello to all of the listeners who I met there. So thanks to all of you for your support, and you know who you are. On today's show, we're chatting with Peter Goodman from the University of Auckland. And no, that's not where the Auks come from. It's New Zealand's biggest city. Peter's an interesting chap, and we spoke about the security of open source software. One of the big advantages of open source is that anyone can audit the code. But really, who does? Who in their right mind gives up their Sunday, like on a sunny day, to pour through some 20-year-old awful code? That's coming up later. Now, this week's sponsor interview is a cracker. We're speaking with Marcus Ranham. Many people say Marcus was the inventor of the proxy firewall, but as you'll hear, he's not one of them. Marcus joined us on the show to chat about innovation in security. He is, of course, Tenable Network Security's Chief Security Officer. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of this week's news headlines with Munir Katadia from ZDNet Australia. And Munir, I guess we should recap last week's AusCert conference, considering we were both there. What did you think of AusCert this year?
I didn't have as much fun as I did last year, but that's because I was running around like an idiot most of the time.
Yeah, well, that's because work were expecting results, because you guys did well last year, hey?
Yeah, it's a shame when you do that. You just, expectations go through the roof, right?
Yeah, yeah. So then you've turned up with a team of like 6 million people, and it was a little bit tougher this year, wasn't it, mate?
It was pretty rough, but yeah, I think we got some great stuff. You'll see it on our site going up over the next couple of weeks or so.
I think the highlight of the whole con for me was people going up to you and saying, hey, aren't you that guy from that podcast?
There were quite a few of those. Yeah, you have a bit of a following there, Pat.
Well, so do you, which is funny. It's like, well, actually, I'm the editor of the biggest IT website in Australia. But,
but the podcast is fun too.
I'm the dude from the podcast. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, we had Scott Charney's keynote, which was surprisingly interesting.
I like the way you say that. Yeah, he was. He was pretty good. I mean, he came and kicked it off. I didn't think he was as interesting as Ivan last year, who kicked it off, who totally got everyone talking when he said desktop security was dead. But yeah, Scott was pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah,
he's got
an
amazing background, hasn't he, in law enforcement. I mean, and he started off just as Bill Gates announced the Trustworthy Computing Initiative. So he's the man there who's told to set up and make Microsoft software secure. So
we've also had, was it Brian Snow, who was from the National Security Agency? He was very very interesting bloke.
He was fantastic. Oh, he spoke so quickly, and he kind of like had this kind of electronic voice, you know, and the way he
speaks. Well, that's it. I think it was one of your guys, Matthew Oxley, who's your video producer, who said there was one thing that they really wanted to ask Brian Snow to do, which is to say, coming this summer. He really had that voiceover voice, you know. Oh. But of course, you know, being someone who was a technical director at the NSA, to have him come out and be able to do a presentation. Anyone interested in downloading that presentation can go to itradio.com.au/AusCert08 to find that. But that's definitely worth a listen. So, I mean, this is all still on day one. I mean, there was a bunch of stuff, wasn't there? There was the Shadow Server Foundation guy. He was all right.
Day two kicked off with John Stewart from Cisco, Cisco's CSO, actually, talking about antivirus products and current patching and current security methods, basically being a waste of money.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, always nice to have a little bit of controversy there. And then after him, we had, what's his name, William Cheswick, who's, you know, been doing security researcher since before I was researcher, shortly after I was born, I should actually say. But, you know, he's a guy from AT&T, did work on firewalls in the 80s, and he was very funny.
Do you know, I missed that one completely, but we recorded a video interview with him, so I'll be able to listen to that real soon.
Well, and you can listen to the whole presentation on IT Radio.
You know. We're totally fighting for this one, aren't we?
We totally are. It's funny.
If you want to hear it, then go to IT Radio. If you want to see it, then come to zdnet.com.au.
Yeah. This is like Kevin Rudd and Joe Hockey on Sunrise. This is awesome. When friends become adversaries.
Very
adversaries, my friend. It's got to be said like James Bond. But yeah, look, I mean, I think we've osserted to death, but I mean, generally the vibe was pretty good. The hangovers were worse than last year because we're all getting a bit bloody old, and yeah, fun stuff.
Again, it was well worth going to. There's some amazing people there, and yes, we're definitely going to be there next year.
Yeah, no, I think I will be too. That was my sixth in a row, so it would seem silly to stop now. All right, but I mean, hey, I managed to scoop one story that was pretty cool on the last day that I was there, which was last Thursday, which is Telstra distributed a malware-infected USB drive to tutorial attendees on day four of OSCET.
This is rather humorous. I completely missed it because I was back in Sydney at that time. But apparently one of the tutorial sessions, they handed out these key drives and they had some kind of like malware on them, which was the auto-run variety.
Yeah, yeah, just an auto-run virus, and it's just hilarious. It's deliciously ironic that, you know, a company trying to promote itself as a, you know, competent security outfit goes, oh, here you go, here's a USB key, have a little bit of virus, you know, it's funny.
Yeah,
and it's funny because it's Telstra, and everyone loves to hang shit on Telstra.
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah, it was a good move, well done.
Yeah, cool, so that's that story. Next up, I think this came from Bill Cheswick's, the interview you guys did with Bill Cheswick, but... He says, banks should stop forcing customers to create long alphanumeric passwords because they can't protect against today's threats.
Yeah,
and he's got
right.
a point, doesn't he?
It's a brilliant quote here. He calls it arcane password fascism.
Yeah.
It's a great, great quote line there. But yeah, basically he's saying that people, you know, if they're forced to make, forced to use really large passwords, with characters and numbers and that kind of thing, then they're not going to remember them. And yeah. It's just ridiculous. So
they should, you know, look at defense in depth. Actually, you know, our sponsor, RSA, was on the show. They're one of our sponsors there on the show a little while ago saying, you know, we've got to look at stuff like originating IP and user agent and things like that. And, you know, really look at trying to identify people through their habits, not just their passwords and not just tokens, but, you know, really looking at a user behavior sort of thing. So just relying on a ridiculously long password. I mean, I don't care if your password's the first chapter of War and Peace. It's not going to defeat a keylogger, is it?
It's true.
Now, this was an interesting little bite that you guys got. Kimberly Zenz from iDefense. She's iDefense's Russia expert. And she reckons that Russian criminals love Australian banks because we've got, you know, so few of them here in Australia.
That's right, relative to our population. So, you know, there's only like five or whatever banks and now...
big ones, anyway.
Exactly, yeah. And because of that, when they're doing a phishing attack or whatever, you know, they go and send out the attack and they're more likely to hook someone, really, because it's less customization involved. If you look at the US and there's so many different banks there that they have to customize each time they want to target someone. So, yeah, it makes Australia a much, much bigger target.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just a very concise way of explaining it, isn't it? You know, when you've got that many banks in the US and, you're sending out your phishing emails, you know, you just got it's a much lower likelihood that you're actually going to hit genuine customers of that particular bank. So.
And she was a great speaker, wasn't she, Kimberly?
Oh, she was fantastic. I did an interview with her as well. That's up on the site and got a presentation. I was very impressed, actually. I mean, she's 31 years old, something like that. And, has a master's in Russian economics and just speaks five languages.
You know...
And she's also the captain of the Nepalese, the U.S., elephant polo team in Nepal.
I was going to mention that as well. Apparently they're fifth in the world when it comes to elephant polo.
There you go. So she's a very, very, very interesting woman and very accomplished and, you know, definitely the sort of person you meet and you go, wow, she's smart.
Yeah, we definitely want to see her again next year.
Yeah, yeah. Now, moving away from OSCET
news,
this is a great little AAP story, Australian Associated Press story, about the head of ASIO urging, ASIO, of course, being Australia's peak sort of spy body, sort of like our CIA. They've urged businesses to assess IT security because individuals and nations are targeting the private sector to steal sensitive information. It's no shit Sherlock, but it's still nice to see an acknowledgement from ASIO, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like you say, it's nothing exactly new. Yes, we know they're being attacked, but he goes on to talk about IT-related devices, like software, mobile phones and other things like that, which are now in common use, and he goes, they're potential attack vectors, basically.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is really interesting to see Australia's, you know, super spy master jumping up and down going, oi, you know, take care of this stuff.
Yep.
Or not it actually gets people's ass into gear. I mean, you know, it might. It might actually take this to the top of an organisation and get, you know, chair people and CEOs and stuff interested in this shiznit.
Well, let's hope so. It's about time.
It's about time, that's right. Okay, so in another story, just also by Liam, he interviewed...
Mikko Hipponen.
Mikko Hipponen, a Finnish security researcher, who says, forget about pointing the finger at China, because China's just a staging point for attacks. He says you may as well blame Denmark.
I thought this was really funny. No, and Mikko, I don't know if you've ever spoken to him. He's a really funny guy, very, very smart indeed. And he's just pointing out that, you know, everyone's blaming China, but there's no real evidence. And even if there is, you know, the chances are that these guys want you to think it's China because they're such a big target. You know, me and you have been talking about this for weeks and weeks and weeks, saying, oh, no, look, people are pointing their finger at China again. And he's just saying, come on, guys. Yes, I know the attacks are made to look like they're from China, but come on, they might well be from Denmark.
Well, our sponsor interview this week is with Marcus Ranham, who is, of course, the Chief Security Officer of Tenable Network Security. Mm-hmm. And this week we're talking about innovation in security, but I'd had a previous conversation with Marcus about this, and he said, look, you know, it could be Liechtenstein. We just don't know. And the fact is there are so many vulnerable boxes in China. It's, you know, it's the world's biggest Lee Harvey Oswald when it comes to this sort of stuff, you know? So really, it's, you know, I got to say I agree. And we've had conversations along those lines on this show before.
Yep. Yep.
Now, this one, interesting also, this presentation is up at itradio.com.au/ossert08, but it was Stephen Stroud from the Attorney General Department talking about Cyberstorm 2, which is, of course, the global war game, which is designed to basically test our robustness, our critical infrastructure's robustness in a all-out cyber attack. And he said, basically, the wheels fell off.
Yeah, he says that the participating organizations, because they became short-sighted under the simulated attacks. And he goes on to say that the incident response teams, they were putting out spot fires here and there, and no one took a step back to see the whole house was on fire.
Go Stroudy. Yeah, nice turn of phrase there.
It's a great line there. Great quotes.
Well, it was a fantastic little presentation. He had one third of the time. I think he only spent about 7 or 8 minutes talking about it, and he just blasted through it and basically said, yep, everyone had these great incident response plans that completely went out the window when there was an actual incident. And, you know, as he said, what was it? How did he term it? He said, you know, normally you don't hit your hand. When you hit your hand with a hammer, you're not surprised that it hurts. But in Cyberstorm 2, there were people hitting their hands with hammers and going, my God, why does that hurt? That was his way of explaining what happened during Cyberstorm 2. But, you know,
I mean, that's why we have these kind of tests, right? To like iron out these kind of incidents. So hopefully all of these guys taking part in it will have learned something.
Well, he actually said that it was a success before it began because, you know, when you scope out a project like this, it actually improves, you know, response plans and things like that and actually makes people aware of things that they wouldn't have been aware of otherwise, you know, and coming into the actual exercise, they know that they need to make this better and that better. So, you know, in that regard, it was already a success. I also liked where he described it as all singing, all dancing. He said, you know, we do Cyberstorm, which is our all singing, all dancing thing, and then we have other things dotted in between. But that's a great little quote there. Now this story I think is very interesting, but a project funded by the US Department of Homeland Security has been covertly scanning open source code looking for bugs.
Yeah, that's right. They looked at bugs in, 250 open source projects, basically, and they didn't say exactly which applications and whatever had the bugs, but they said they found some common themes here.
Yeah, well, I think the scariest bit is that they actually said the most common type of code defect, accounting for 28% of all the defects found, is a null pointer dereference. What I think is interesting about that is, of course, Mark Dowd has just done some very interesting research, which he discussed on this show some time ago, which makes null pointer dereferences exploitable. So,
oh, right, okay.
Yeah, so
This is all like coding stuff, which is a bit over my head, I must admit.
Well, you know, it's just these previously were thought to be, you know, not much more than denial of service bugs, and Dowd sort of came out and went, nah. And actually figured out how to exploit them a little bit more reliably. So it's not to say that all of these bugs will be exploitable, but hey, you know, it's interesting. I guess it should be noted that they pointed out some things that were actually pretty tight, including Amanda, NTP, OpenPAM, OpenVPN, Perl, PHP, Python, and Samba.
Phew, that's a relief.
Well, it is. You know, a lot of people use Samba, a lot of people use PHP. Everyone uses Perl, and Python's like everyone thinks is the next, you know, God, it's the second coming. Like, they love Python. They love it. And we've got one more news item. Is that right, Manim?
Yeah, there's a little story about CommBank data centers getting biometrics. Apparently, the Commonwealth Bank taking extra steps to protect its data centers, and it's expanding the use of biometric access. I don't know. I don't know if it's a huge deal, because I'd be really surprised. I'm actually really surprised that they haven't all got biometrics anyway. I mean, isn't that standard? You need this serious security to, like, protect your data centers.
Well, do you remember that ad for ANZ Bank where the guy's, like, walking through and showing off all the security features of their data center, you know? And he's, like, does the secret handshake with the robotic arm, and he does the iris scan and the voice imprint. And then a key pops out, and he uses a key, and it gets stuck. And he knocks on the door and says, can someone let me in? And it's a little bit... It's quite accurate, actually, I'd say.
Yeah.
So not necessarily surprised that they haven't had it already, but, you know, it's always nice to see someone shoring up their physical access.
Totally, yeah.
Although you'd have to be pretty bloody ballsy to do a physical attack on a bank's data center, wouldn't you?
Well, you would be, but, I mean, they're the ones that get the best results, right?
Yeah, like those guys who were dressed up in EDS uniforms a few years ago and stole those mail servers from Sydney Airport. That was
That's
hilarious.
Right. That was a massive deal.
Still laughing about it years later. All right, Moon, that's going to be it, mate. So thank you very much for coming onto the show and talking about the news again this week.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, mate. I'll talk to you again soon.
Mania Katadia from ZDNet Australia there with a look at this week's news headlines and a recap of the AusCert conference. Next up, it's time to chat to Peter Goodman. Peter's a well-known crypto expert and a general security whiz. Regular listeners may have heard his KiwiCon keynote on risky business. I split it into two parts and gave it the title Bugs in the Brain. Now, if you haven't heard it, go check it out. I'll link to it from the post of this podcast. Anyway, in that keynote in November last year, Peter said open source software auditing was a bit of a joke. Everyone assumes everyone else will audit open code, but in reality, no one does. And because there are so many people involved in open source, coders always assume that someone else has gotten around to it. And he equates that to the real-life bystander effect, which we'll get into in a little while. Well, his words were a tad prophetic. The Debian disaster, in which a flaw in the operating system's random number generator was sitting there in a public code repository for a year and a half unnoticed, couldn't be a more apt proof of what Peter was talking about. It's a perfect example. So I caught up with Peter at AusCert's conference on the Gold Coast and started off by asking him to explain what the bystander effect is.
So the thing with the bystander effect is it was based on an incident that happened in 1964 in New York City. A bar manager was coming home late at night and was attacked and raped and stabbed repeatedly. And the attacker was scared away and then came back again and was scared away and came back again. And this kind of shocked people because there was this perception that New Yorkers were callous. And so this sort of played to the stereotype. What happened is, depending on which version of the story you see, there were exaggerated and distorted reports. But the perception that what was reported is that the neighbours listened to this woman being attacked and didn't do anything. In fact, eventually they did something. And that was known as the bystander effect. And so people have actually studied this, and they found that the more people you add around a scene, the less likely any one individual is to take actually any action. And so the problem with the internet is, you know, the bystander effect occurs once you've got two or even three people. On the internet, you've got several billion people. So it's the worst possible case to deploy something that's actually vulnerable to the bystander effect.
And people won't actually do anything because they assume the next person's doing something, like calling the cops or getting a gun or something like that, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, that's one example that I've seen in a psychology text. They said, if you're ever in trouble and you're lying on the ground, there's a crowd of people around you, don't say, help me. Point to one individual person and say, you call the cops or you help me, because the bystander effect then doesn't work. And the example in this case, with the Debian software, or with actually a bunch of other pieces of software where security holes have been found, everyone assumed that someone else has looked at it. And the end result is nobody's actually looked at it and nothing gets done.
Now, I wonder who really wants to spend their sunny Saturdays poring through Debian source. How is this a security model that anyone thinks is plausible?
You pretty much have to, and this is unfortunate. I'm going to use Microsoft as an example because they've got the security development lifecycle, and they actually build this auditing into the process. So what they say is, for example, if you're working on security-related code, you need a security expert, a domain expert, a cryptographer, whatever, to sign off on this before you ship any changes. So this, you know, this is going to sound very much business process model and closed source and you know, what we don't want, that sort of thing. But, you know, this is actually a business process model and a development process model issue. And the Debian one was basically a failure that one guy could change a critical component, and this guy wasn't a security person as far as we know, and it shipped without any apparent review.
Don't you think that says some pretty bad things about open source security in general? Can we extend this beyond Debian and say that the argument that open source is open and actually sitting in a code repository that anyone can view? I mean, everyone talks about this as being a huge plus, but if people are not reviewing the code, and it seems that they're not, when a critical component of a random number generator in a major operating system can sit there broken for a year and a half before somebody notices, can we still use this as an argument in the pro column for open source security?
Well, it depends. If you see things as very black and white, if you say open source is always good no matter what and closed source is always bad no matter what.
Well, no, I wasn't trying to say that, but I mean, is that still a tick in the pro column, you know?
I don't think it's been a good argument even to begin with. You know, if you look at the first known vulnerability that I know of in random number generation was in PGP 1.0, the XOR bytes bug from 1991. It was discovered in 1994. It's a long time ago, and there have been an ongoing series of bugs in random number generation. I've only tracked that because it's, you know, one single thing you can focus on. It's happened again and again and again. So, you know, saying that many eyes make bugs shallow only works, as you say, if many eyes are looking at the code. If no one's looking at the code, then the bugs don't get discovered.
Well, and that's where I think the proprietary vendors might have actually picked up a bit of an edge here, is because they're paying people to go through the code. Now that vendors are actually doing SDL, and it's not just Microsoft, serious vendors are all doing SDL, and it means that they actually have a code review process. It's not like, hey, we'll just put it in this bucket and hope someone looks at it.
Right. And that's, you know, that's one of the advantages of being a proprietary vendor, or at least of making money out of it. You can be open source and you can make money out of it. The thing is, you can give people money to look at this. Doing code audits is one of the most boring, mind-numbing tasks you can possibly imagine.
This is what I've never understood about open source. Who does this on a Saturday?
Right. Nobody voluntarily does code audits. You incentivize them. One way of incentivizing them is you release O-Day or whatever, and then they have to go out and fix it. But more generally, yeah, you give them some sort of an incentive, and the most obvious incentive is you give them money or some alternative. Heck, you buy them free beers if they're geeks, whatever. But you have to incentivize people to do this because otherwise it won't get done.
Do you reckon we're actually going to see any exploits in the wild on this Debian thing, or do you think it's been blown out of proportion a bit?
Predicting the future is always a risky business, so I'm not going to try and predict the future. The problem with this is that OpenSSL is more or less the default crypto implementation for a huge pile of Unix distributions. The problem is we've got OpenSSL buried under something else, and, you know, five levels down, you don't even know it's there anymore. And yet somewhere there's a copy of OpenSSL from several years ago that, let's say, one of the unpatched versions. You don't even know it exists, and you've got this unpatched copy running there. So I expect at some point, yes, there are going to be leftover copies that people don't even know exist that will be exploited.
See, I've just got this mental image at the moment of all these, like, guys in a dark, windowless room at the NSA just jumping up and down for joy because they've got all these stored SSL sessions that they've been trying to crack, and all of a sudden, you know, it's a bit of a gimme. So I'd imagine there's plenty of stored traffic that's being popped open at the moment.
Yeah, it's hard to speculate on that. I think more likely we're going to see it. That's the standard with any kind of exploit. We're going to see this built into code scanning tools. And, for example, there's a fixed number of keys that are generated, and there's scripts to generate to detect that. So we're going to start seeing it built into malicious code scanning tools and whatever. And the malware will start looking for this vulnerable version of OpenSSL. So it's pretty much like any other vulnerability that's discovered. You know, you build scripts or whatever code scanners to detect it, and you either defend against it or exploit it, depending on what you want to do with it.
Do you think, I mean, quite often proprietary vendors have actually said that they've learned a lot of lessons from open source, and I guess SDL actually is kind of a part of that, in that they've looked at the idea of code review but then incentivized it and actually turned it into a process. So that was sort of a lesson that was taken from the open source community, improved, and then deployed in the commercial world. Do you think it's maybe time that the open source guys actually did a little bit of... took a leaf out of the book of the proprietary guys and incentivized code audits, saying, hey, look, if you want to contribute this little widget and get your name on this project, you've got to do X amounts of X hours of code review?
I'm not actually sure how you would incentivize someone for an open source project. I mean, you know, you're a geek, you want to sit there and you want to hack out code and you want to add cool features. You don't want to audit someone else's spaghetti code. I'm not actually certain how you could do this. I mean, I'm sure lots of people have different suggestions. You know, maybe vendors could donate sort of cool hardware or something like that. And if you sit down and you prove you spend X amount of time, then you get the cool hardware.
Win an iPod Shuffle sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. The problem with that is, again, you're relying on honesty. I mean, if you've got a commercial operation, you've got a manager breathing down your neck. You've got this sort of this auditing built into the process. But otherwise, I can say I've audited 10,000 lines of code. Give me my free iPod Shuffle. There are some things that just work. Some things work better with open source. Some things work better with closed source, or at least with a hierarchical structured organization to impose certain constraints.
Yes, you know, I've never been one to actually get into the religious war about whether or not open source is more secure than proprietary, because I think it's a ridiculous question.
Right.
Because, you know, you're talking about two extremely large fields there. But, I mean, it does increasingly look like the whole idea about whether or not something is inherently more secure just because the source is open or not, I mean, it just... I think it's got a lot more to do with who coded it and how, doesn't it?
Right, exactly. It's who coded it, who audited it, and, you know, what sort of processes were in place to make sure that random changes like the Debian OpenSSL fix, for example, couldn't actually cause any damage.
Were you almost like kind of getting a chuckle out of that? Because you've, you know, you more or less said, this is the problem with open source, and then very quickly afterwards we see this absolute clangor pop up. You must have had a bit of a chuckle.
Well, it's something I'd rather not see. I mean, seeing a critical security...
But you're smiling.
Break, well, yeah, but seeing a critical computer security component break like that is always a really nasty thing to have happen.
But it's nice to be right, isn't it?
Well, in some cases, I'd rather be wrong. What this does provide is a great illustrative example. I mean, we need a kind of smoking gun to wake people up every now and then. And this is a smoking gun, and hopefully this will wake people up.
You reckon this will change something? Anything?
Okay, it may or may not change something. The thing is, when we've got somebody who says, you know, we're doing just fine at the moment, we can just keep doing what we're doing now, then people can point back at this and say, here's an example of where it didn't work and we need to fix something.
Peter Goodman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Peter Goodman there, speaking to Risky Business at AusCert's conference on the Gold Coast. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview, and this week we're speaking to Marcus Ranham, Tenable Network Security's CSO. He's one of those guys who enjoys a strange type of celebrity for his accomplishments in the security field. Most people attribute the development of the proxy firewall to Ranham, but as you'll hear, he's not one of them. But there's no doubting that he is an innovator. So I thought I'd ask Ranham about innovation in security in the year 2008. Why have fresh approaches to solving our information security problems seemingly dried up?
What's going on is that there are basic problems that remain the same. And those problems are things like can you trust code and can you trust data and how do you mediate things going across frontiers in your networks. And so there are these basic problems that remain the same, and the solutions to those problems tend to remain the same. And so we keep coming back as whenever we come up with something new, voice over IP, you know, everybody goes, woo, there's all these new ideas in voice over IP. But you've still got the basic problem that you have to carry data back and forth across a perimeter, and how are you going to do that? And so somebody's going to go, hey, let's build a voice over IP firewall. And it's going to look just like, you know, all of the other firewalls. And by the way, I didn't invent the proxy firewall, and I don't claim that. I did make the first successful commercial firewall product, and this is relevant to the whole question of innovation. The ideas for proxy firewalls have been floating around for a long time. The ideas for firewalls have been floating around for a long time. A lot of us aren't really quite sure, you know, who did it first. It probably was Dave Prezzato at Bell Labs who gets the claim of the first firewall and the first firewall proxies.
Look, I mean, it just seems to me that things have kind of stalled. They've just hit this innovation brick wall. And, you know, we're seeing a couple of new things, like what the guys at Bit9 are doing is kind of interesting, but it's hardly new. Like whitelisting as a concept, you know, execution control, this isn't new. Nothing's new.
Yeah, that goes back to what? Multics, I guess. None of it's new. And that's because the problems are the same. And, you know, what's really interesting is at a certain point, you know, you can almost see this as a sign in some cases of either epic failure or victory, because if in security, if you're able to push your problem to the point where the weakest link is a human, then, you know, you've won. That's as good as it's going to get. If the weakest link is a human, then you're always going to be susceptible to people purchasing access into your system, in other words, traitors, or fooling people, which is what we're starting to see now with a lot of these phishing attacks. So you know, in a sense, what may be happening is kind of that things are as good as they're going to get in some areas, and then in other places, of course, they're as bad as they can possibly get, and that's where you're always seeing the new innovation. People going, gosh, you know, we just fielded this protocol and put it on everybody's desktop, and it sucks. Now what are we going to do? And somebody goes, let's make a firewall. Hey, we'll make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is conceivable that, you know, a competent chief security officer with a good team of technical staff managing a medium-sized network with an appropriate budget could actually make people the weakest link. I mean, that is conceivable, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've seen that happen a couple of times. I mean, I've got a couple friends, one of them was a, you know, big shot security guy in biotech, and, you know, their network was about as tight as it can be made, simply because they did a very good job of effectively communicating to people what the problems were, and they had support from on high. And the biggest problem was consistently that, you know, competitors were trying to buy their people.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess really the core tenets of security, like when we look at it from a technology point of view, you know, you're going to have your kit in there, like a, you know, firewall, you're going to have an IDS or IPS, probably SIM, which is an area you guys are big in. your security information management console, taking information from multiple devices. You're going to have your scanning technology as well, looking at you from the outside and from the inside. You're going to be patching the crap out of absolutely everything, taking a regular inventory. I mean, these are the basic, CSO tasks, aren't they, that we're just going to need to continue doing into the future. And really, we're just going to see enhancements of those existing technologies and maybe the introduction of more whitelisting, but not necessarily some revolutionary, bit of security kit that's going to come and take all our problems away.
Right. We're going to see the same old, as long as we insist on doing computing the way that we're doing computing. There are potential ways that we could completely break out of that cycle. I winced when you said, patching everything all the time. And of course, for someone who works at Tenable, which is, we do Nessus, of course, patching is implicitly a big piece of what we're involved with. But from a design standpoint, when you're constantly patching your system, what you're really doing is you're saying, I accept that my system sucks. In fact, it sucks so badly that it can't survive unprotected on the internet without my constantly messing with it, which is just a terrible design philosophy. I mean, you obviously, if your computing is mission critical, it should be something that's capable of surviving on the internet for, more than 15 minutes. So, now what does it entail in order to build those kinds of systems? Well, it means that, you'd need systems that maybe had different sets of capabilities than what the end users think they want. You might want to...
But don't you think, come on, Marcus, that horse has bolted. I mean, the war between the computer science graduates and the computer systems engineering graduates, that's over. The computer science kids, they won. Do you know what I mean? And they write shit code and it's everywhere. So, we're not going to take the functionality hit that's going to be required to actually tighten that stuff up. And there's always going to be feature exploitation issues anyway.
It's such early days. Don't forget that. I mean, in the very early days of aviation, anybody who wanted to could build something with two wings, and if it had enough power to get itself in the air, they'd go fly around in it until they hit something. And those guys died. And it took what, 50 years or so of innovation in aviation to the point where people finally sat down and matured it. And
so, do we just have to hope that? So do we just have to hope the computer science graduates explode?
Honestly, I think so. We gotta wait for, there's going to be a lot of deaths eventually. I mean, it's gonna happen sooner or later that there will be disasters and there will be life lost. And then people are going to sit there and go, wow, we need to take this stuff seriously.
But the economic cost of real security is going to be extreme. I mean, it's going to be like a nation-building project to actually take all of this commonly used stuff and lock it down. I mean, it's a colossally huge project that you're suggesting.
But building a Boeing 747 instead of just having everybody flying around in Blériot monoplanes was just mind-bogglingly expensive as well. And the other thing that comes up a lot in all of this that, I try to get people to think about in terms of the future is eventually this is going to become a battlefield. It's really not a battlefield yet, but eventually cyberspace is going to become a battlefield. And when it does, then you get into the battle, into the warfighter mentality in which failure just is not an option, right? In the Middle Ages, when you were building a castle and you were the chatelaine or the castellan and responsible for, building a medieval strong fort, If the merchant guys came and said, no, we want a hole in the wall because your walls interrupt our business, you just throw them into the moat, right? Because it was a matter of life and death, and people understood it was a matter of life and death. And someday, I'm telling you, this internet security stuff is going to be a matter of life and death, and people are not going to say, I'm going to put my entire life at risk so that I can have cool animated dancing pigs on my cell phone.
Yeah. No, look, sensible advice indeed. But that's all we're going to have time for, Marcus. So thank you very much for joining us again on Risky Business.
Oh, my pleasure.
Mark. Marcus Ranham from Tenable Network Security there with this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this week's show. Next week's podcast will be brought to you from the Juniper Networks JTech Forum in Bangkok. The infinitely wise marketing and PR departments from Juniper decided to fly me there so Risky Business could meet some Juniper customers. Presumably the happy ones, but still I'm confident that we'll find some interesting stories there. And a suntan, and some garlic and pepper beef, some red and green curry, and some genuine $10 designer jeans. This week's Sound Foundation track is Old Man by Danny Carr, and you can buy it for $1.40 at soundfoundation.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Oh, 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 oh